You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Chris Morris. I'm talking to him from Connecticut. Chris, thanks so much for being with me today.
Glad to be here.
So, Chris, let's talk about your practice. I know you're trained as an architect and work as an artist, but can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, perhaps, and how you're approaching that through the lens of an architect, an artist?
Yes, recently I did not become one of the finalists for the Barack Obama Presidential Library. I made a very conscientious and thorough entry to that. I can discuss that in detail, but having not made the finalists, I'm sort of between a rock and a hard place with architecture right now. So I've regrouped and stretched a canvas, and I've just completed one, and it's really a celebration of post-impressionism, but it's reinterpreted. I actually have a narrative going on where it's the Statue of Liberty in a prequel situation before she becomes a gift to the United States from France.
Sure. And what was the Presidential Library? Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit? Because how I don't know much about how you apply for that or how that works. What was the process there?
Before there was even a competition, before they had formally made a request for qualifications, I submitted something to the White House, and I anticipated that it would be the Chicago site as opposed to one being considered in New York City and his home state of Hawaii. And then there were two sites in Chicago, and I chose I anticipated the correct one chosen. That was the Frederick Law Olmsted Park. So that set up a great narrative, and I invoked Italian enunciations to look at both urbanity or an urban context at the edge of a garden. In the Annunciation, we have the Angel Gabriel coming from the left and the Virgin Mary on the right, who's usually hovered in some kind of niche or villa. And in this case, it's the urban edge, and it is adjacent to or at the edge of Frederick Law Olmsted's garden. So here I'm investigating a bridge towards the future, which was a common theme in the Bill Clinton Library. But here it's readily apparent that the urban edge is that edge to the future and a brighter future, and I'm able to use the Frederick Law Olmsted garden or park as a very optimistic first step.
And this is a very interesting kind of approach, interesting that kind of, let me just to stay with this idea for a little bit, because that kind of work, and also coming from, you know, background as an architect, this kind of visual work, and what you're talking about is the piece that, work that will be acquired for the Barack Obama Presidential Library post his presidency, is that correct?
That's right.
And so this, as you're describing, you know, that painting, this really is a kind of historical narrative, isn't it? And is that what's called for in this case?
Pardon me?
Is that what's called for? Like as what you're describing sounds like a historical narrative more than most in work. It's kind of an unusual commission or competition. Was the narrative specific in that competition that had to be addressed within the work?
Yes, I mean, that's the option for the entrance to consider, but in all presidential libraries, it's a culmination of a great achievement or body of work, but at the same time, every president retires always saying that there's more work to be done, so it's really a tabula rasa, a starting point for what needs to be done further, but it's not without some historical reference to what has been achieved, what is yet anticipated, and what will, with any hope, be accomplished in the future.
And I've never toured presidential libraries before and looked at the work in there, But I guess you're familiar with that context, and and in that context, does the work have a similar narrative quality? Is it kind of all over the place, or does it tend to address specific issues, often historical?
They're usually a chronological arrangement of, well, books, because we're dealing with a library, but in this modern age, it's a digital link or connection to information access. And then scattered about will be items that recall the legacy and items that can be used as art, and sources of inspiration for those visiting to then make the next step forward. And again, in this case, I'm really using a very big connection between that which is built and that which is anticipated to expand, but not without the context of, again, the Frederick Law Olmsted garden or park, so that despite or because of the urban setting that Chicago has, we're still encouraged to think freely and tap to the spirit of this country being plentiful in land and opportunity.
Right, and hope for the future.
Exactly.
And so what happened with this competition? You found out that you didn't win and awarded to it?
I had submitted this before this was even announced to be a competition. So by the time it's received, and having not received any word back from the White House, there was this big public announcement for a request for qualifications, which did not ask for any solutions. Now, when you're getting a request for qualification, you're putting together some images, but they specifically said not to submit any with regard to the library, but it's more or less a resume and your track record. And you team up with other architects and engineers to be a compelling team. They skipped right over any middle phase where many were considered, so they went straight from 140 considerations, which was how many people responded to the request for qualifications, to six finalists. So that's quite a step. Now, the six finalists are great, and I'm very happy, and they'll no doubt get a great building, but I was really hoping for some opportunity to verbally express what I had visually sent to the White House.
Well, because they narrowed them down just from the resumes alone without even looking at work.
Right. That's right. So there was no guarantee that any of them were, passionate Obama fans like I am, nor was there any guarantee that any of them could be passionate about submitting an appropriate and suitable library. But nonetheless, the six are, without a doubt, six of the top 25 or 30 architects in the country. I mean, in the world, there were international finalists.
So let's talk about, and they were architects or artists, like the six finalists. They were collaborations in the end between architects
and
artists?
These were all architects principally, but I'm sure all of them have some sort of art determinant addressed, whether they themselves are artistically inclined or have artists on board.
That's interesting, but most of it isn't actually an individual artist with no architectural background applying. Everyone is either an architect collaborating with one or has that background.
Yes.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about how your background, how you got into the arts from architecture, and because I know we talked a little bit off the record before we started talking about, kind of being too much architect for the artist and too much artist for the architect. So we'll get to that, topic. But how did you make the bridge from architecture to art?
To start, we should discuss how I made the connection from art as a high school student to architecture, and that was more pragmatic. That was more of a pragmatic means to invoke a college education. Back when I was applying for college, RISD, for instance, didn't have an architecture school yet, and I was looking at that for art, but then it occurred to me that maybe 4 years, 5 years, and then with master's, it's even more, that pursuing architecture would be a more worthwhile endeavor academically. So that's when I chose architecture. But because of my passion for art, I've always come at it as an artist, and with references made earlier, I'm very connected to the Italian Renaissance, which really is a simultaneity between art, sculpture, and architecture, painting, sculpture, and architecture. And
absolutely, you're talking about the Renaissance being drawn to that, and of course, Vasari's book and the way artists and as you're saying, art and architecture and so much in design, all were hand in hand. They weren't seemingly even separate schools. It all happened within Michelangelo's studio, right, or Brunelleschi's studio.
Well, Michelangelo is one of the great artists of all time. In that, all three disciplines, painting, sculpture, and architecture are all slam dunked with this guy, and he was a poet. So, you know, in this day and age, you look at you know, specialty work and focus. So very rarely, I can think maybe Christo was our most recent sculptor, painter, architect. People say, well, where's the architecture? But it's a sculpture that you get to live in and experience like architecture. But I can't think of too many people other than, say, Christo today that deals with those disciplines. I sort of skip over the sculptural element, but I do paint. And I do, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm a failed architect. I have had buildings built. My batting average to have that done isn't as exactly high, but and many of my architectural pieces remain on paper, which is unfortunate, but nevertheless, some do get built. With art as a plan B, you know, I'm 63 years old and I'm not building, so I'm stretching canvases.
Well, that sounds good. And as you stretch canvases and as you've painted and exhibited for years now, you were talking about sort of the rub between art and architecture, or being too much artist for the architects or too much architect for the artist. Maybe we could talk about that for a second, because I hear one of the great things about interviewing a lot of people is I hear such varying things on that. I hear from, you know, one architect, oh, you know, artists, you know, their work sells for such high money, and, you know, it's often garbage and nobody appreciates architecture. I've talked to other architects who say, you know, I love working with artists. Artists are like the blood of architecture. Right. So there seems to be such a variety of opinions on that.
Right. Yeah, again, as an architect, as someone who's, rational and practical in terms of fulfilling a public service, as an architect, keep the water out from underneath and make sure you're thermally controlled and that sort of thing. But taking that pragmatic and then jumping into art, my pragmatism there is to strive for something that can be achieved and hung on the wall. Too often today, art is of an enormity that is not user-friendly for the home. Now, I understand with the progress and the work that continues to progress in art, we're inclined to deal with big things, deal with bulldozered dirt in warehouses at the Mass MoCA, for instance, or conceptual art, and that's all fine and wonderful. But again, as an architect, I'm more into the pragmatic. So if I'm to spend any time, I'm looking. And perhaps optimistically, or maybe not optimistic enough, I'm looking to return art to canvases that can be hung on the wall.
And what's your experience in getting the work out there? Is there, as an architect, does it seem that it's not easy to inhabit both worlds. I mean, it certainly should be, but as you interact with the art world and your canvases, what happens? Do you
Well, in all my proposals for buildings, they are certainly not without beautiful renderings and elevations and sections. And I take the elevations and sections to a painterly level so that in the event, for instance, if the Obama Foundation still has me on file and they're looking for work to address the architecture, they can certainly take some of the elevations and sections that I have done in the submittal and look for ways of incorporating them as murals or punctuated sculpture for their spaces. There was a stint over a decade ago where I was involved with Alexis Rockman, the great painter, who is a Darwinian by belief, but paints like Rembrandt. And he paints these wonderful paintings of the future and how they're how we're going to be compromised by global warming and disease and that sort of thing. So,
right, biological and environmental issues are often that work.
Right, and so his paintings needed to be architecturally informed. Now, he's great at nature. He paints the great Garden of Eden, but as soon as it needs Noah's Ark or something like that, that's where I come in. So he and I worked side by side. So he actually had come to an architect to help him, and in that process found me. So Alexis and I have made that bridge connection between art and architecture. So we'll see how that goes.
That's exciting. So what will be the next step for these canvases? Are you planning on having an exhibit, studio show, or any of these canvases that you're working on or current work in the studio going anywhere?
Yes, two of them are going to be in the Meeting House show here in Roxbury, Connecticut, in a couple of weeks. I submit June the 11th. I think it's going to be on exhibit June 17th. And Roxbury is a very interesting community because there are a lot of artists here and very talented. And it's almost like a support group because we're all talented and none of us have any work. So it's very therapeutic. But we push each other to explore different opportunities and quantum leaps and that sort of thing. So I'm making a big quantum leap here. Again, the painting that I'm very proud of right now is of a Statue of Liberty as a prequel. It's a reclining nude in France before it becomes the gift from France to the United States for the centennial. Let's be reminded here that without the French, we don't win the revolution. Without Lafayette, George Washington is just another soldier. So whatever happened over the years, France and the United States have become kind of aggressive towards each other, but we're reminded with current events that we are attached and we are committed to each other, and that's what this painting wants to reinforce.
I like that. I like that very much. And in closing, the other question I wanted to ask, or I've been asking lately, is there a book that you're reading now? Could be off-topic, fiction, anything at all that you'd want to share?
I read physics. Lisa Randall from Harvard, Knocking on Heaven's Door, and the book that she currently has out, it's Dinosaurs and Dark Matter, or The Dark Matter and Dinosaurs. And that's sort of my my hobby. And Einstein has been very important to me in the last 16 years in terms of mentally addressing that bigger picture. And in my opinion, Einstein is one of our great, great creative thinkers of all time. And yet he didn't paint or sculpt or architect, but in terms of pushing the limits of just the bigger picture thinking, there's nobody finer. And Lisa Randall, who's a Harvard physicist, writes these books that are very compelling. And yes, you have to have somewhat a background in physics to understand some of it, but she does present it to the layperson that can give one hope of getting a handle on this. And I'm told by Lisa that I do have a handle on it, so she's fun.
Well, that's great. And Einstein, when you talk about his writings, I mean, the thing that comes close to that for me is I remember reading, I think, letters Einstein wrote. But when you talk about him, and they were so kind of warm and humanistic and gave this sense of a big picture in a lot of ways. But is there other writings of Einstein that you're talking about that are drawing from besides, you know, theoretical papers that are...
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, there aren't. But yeah, some of the letters and notes and lecture transcripts do indicate that warm and fuzzy appeal to getting a hand on this big picture stuff. And it's unfortunate that Lisa Randall's perhaps an exception, but it's unfortunate most physicists today don't have that capacity, and they frighten too many people. So if my painting doesn't do well, maybe I'll write that book. And I'm looking at a grand unification theory that has eluded people. It's eluded even Einstein, but I'm of a believer that we can solve grand unification, which marries quantum mechanics with relativity. But I think we're searching in the wrong places, and I think before we decide where to search, we do have to make physics something more enjoyable and warm and fuzzy, say. And that's something that scares the crap out of people.
Right. Well, would a unification theory mean something like Hawking's idea of a parallel universe, is that something that would unify? Not that that's
yeah,
the one
well,
or anything,
by,
but is...
By the physics equations that Einstein gave us, we're very certain, I mean, above and beyond doubt, that there needs, by necessity, there needs to be extra dimensions than the four that we're used to, and the fourth being time. So there needs to be six, if not seven, additional dimensions just to explain the equations, which in turn indicate observably that the outer reaches of our universe is exponentially expanding. So that brings in the matters of, literally the matters of dark matter and dark energy, without which these edges don't exponentially expand. So by necessity, there has to be extra dimensions.
And so it's your job and our job to figure out what those dimensions are in order to create a theory that unifies potentially all these dimensions.
At least it's a very tough thing for the limits of space-time, and we as limited creatures can fathom, but we need to at least set up a model about which all of this can work with the missing links of extra dimensions to be determined, and we're probably not going to determine those. But to set up a model that explains or diagrammatically explains the thermodynamics of energy and the expanding edges of the universe.
Chris, it's been really a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks for having me, and I appreciate this very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.